following a paper on Norway with one on the Russian Federation, we're going from one sort of exceptionalism to the other end of the extreme of exceptionalism. It's a very contrast, two very contrasting prison systems. I also have to say that, you know, as soon as my predecessor put up the point about theory and not being descriptive, I thought, oh gosh. I will defend being descriptive about the Russian prison system because so little is known about it. But of course, I'm theoretically engaged in my work, but what I'm doing today is really telling some stories, and I'm very happy to be interrogated on my theoretical framing afterwards. Now, Sarah Badcock and Mikhail Nakonechny were going to be talking about, you know, the theme of our session was penal journeys or carceral journeys, and they were talking about the journeys in Imperial Russia and then during the period of the Stalinist gulag of prisoners, the prison transportations and the use of exile as a punishment form. And I thought to make things different, I would talk about not the prisoners themselves, but the largely, you know, thousands of women who support the men, the 2/3 of a million men in prison in the Russian Federation at the current time. So I'm talking about prisoners once removed, quasi-prisoners in the Russian penal context. And it's based on work for an AHRC grant that has resulted in this book, Waiting at the Prison Gate, that I wrote together with Eleanor Katz. And I'm just taking the opportunity to advertise some previous work that Don was involved in also on women's prisoners. So I've been working largely on women prisoners during the last decade or so. In the work for Waiting at the Prison Gate, we interviewed women in a variety of different subject positions in relation to prisoners in the Russian Federation. So we looked at a broad spectrum of wives and partners of prisoners, so the wives of the rank and file prisoners, they're what we called bandits' wives. These are the wives of the high status prisoners in the prison hierarchy, subcultures. We also looked at what are known as zaochnitsy, who are social media wives. These are women who form a relationship with a prisoner when he's already in prison through the use of social media. But we also interviewed grandmothers, mothers-in-law, children, but they had to be children over the age of 16, and siblings. And what we aimed to do was, what we're interested in, is firstly to look at what society's expectations are of the prisoner's relative in Russia, and particularly the women relatives, the extent to which these societal constructions have been internalized by the women who have a family member in prison, and how that, you know, self-identification in their own identity construction, how that affects the extent to which they are and the ways in which they continue to invest or not in the relationship with the prisoner. Now, because our panel was about carceral journeys, I'm only going to talk about one aspect of being a prisoner's relative in Russia, and that is the question of whether they visit and going to visit the prisoner in prison. And I have to say that, in fact, you know, the vast majority of men prisoners in the Russian Federation are not visited by anyone. So I'm talking about a minority, probably about a third, just over a third, 40%, perhaps a third to 40% of prisoners who are visited by their largely women family members. On the whole, men don't visit the prisons. Now, if I'm looking at the social construction of, you know, what is the appropriate behaviour of a prisoner's wife, mother, whatever, we immediately go back to the 19th century, to the Decembrist officers who revolted against serfdom in 1825 in St. Petersburg. Those who weren't executed were sent off to exile and hard labour, katorga, in Siberia. And a certain number, in fact 11, of their wives, siblings, and siblings followed them to Siberia, and these were known as the Decabristki, the Decembrist women, or the Decembrist wives. Now, the Decembrist wife myth or trope has informed the construction not just of prisoners' relatives, but of women generally in Russia ever since. So the Decabristka trope is alive and well in the Russian Federation at the present time. And it's changed over time, whereas in the early 19th century, it was the appellation of the wife of a member of the intelligentsia. Since the 19th century, it's been democratized, so that any woman who follows her husband, which is what the woman is meant to do in Russia, can take on that appellation of the Decabristka. As happens, for example, it happened to be an oligarch's wife. A quote, this is a quote from one. I am a Decabristka. I am prepared to follow my husband to the Maldives, to Bali. You get the point. So it's been democratized, but where it's applied to prisoners' relatives, it's very serious indeed. And it has a series of elements. And one is it's the image of the self-sacrificial woman. So you sacrifice yourself for your man. And one of the indices of how far you're prepared to sacrifice yourself is indeed, are you prepared to make that long journey to the correctional colony, subject yourself to the demeaning and degrading treatments that you'll get when you're there, and the secondary prisonization that you suffer there? Are you prepared to do that for your man or not? So that's one element of the Decabristka trope. The other is that the woman should also keep him supplied with foods, medicines, and trade goods, so she becomes responsible for the man's well-being whilst in prison. And she's also responsible, and I'll show you a quote from the Russian prison service at the moment, for his moral rectitude, for his rehabilitation. So these are the various jobs that go with being the ideal prisoner's wife in Russia. Now, I've just got one quote here, is just to show that, you know, among, you know, really quite sort of modest, you know, lower socioeconomic classes, they'll quite happily use, and quite often will use, the Decabristka trope. So this is Clara talking about her father and her mother, who waited for him for 30 years also. Like a Decabristka, she followed him to Siberia. The statue is a recently erected statue in Moscow outside the, I think it's the Academy of Art, isn't it, of the 11 Decabristki in the 19th century waiting at the prison gate, hence the title of our book. This is Larisa Petrovna, who is one of the mother-in-laws that we interviewed, but we also interviewed Katya, who's married to a high-status member of the prison hierarchy. And it's just, if you like, a sort of classic exposition or description of what the ideal woman is. And the important thing is, she could abandon him and lead a worldly lifestyle, yet she's dedicated her life just to him. She used to have everything, which she did, because this is a high-up military family we're talking about here. She used to have everything, but she doesn't complain now about suffering. She doesn't see what she's sacrificing to save Igor. And in fact, this family, and it was the only one of all the people we interviewed, had actually moved from a nice, comfortable flat in Moscow over to the Urals to be near Igor whilst he was serving his sentence. I'm going to leave that. So this is what's on the official Russian service website, and as I said, this is recruiting women relatives into the Fugodian task of producing docile bodies. So this is what the prison service says to relatives, what they're meant to be doing. In addition to the rights you have, rights to visit, for example, as relatives of a convicted person, you have a moral obligation to help your loved one to find the right path that will lead him to a correct and normal life after release. In this respect, much depends on you, in that you have a moral and often material responsibility to support the prisoner. So all of this is pretty clear. Right. Just to make a very quick point, I'm sure you're all very aware that the geography of the Russian prison estate is inherited from the Soviet era, and the way in which the prisons
the correctional labour colonies were reconstructed after the end of the Gulag, which left what resulted in a hollowing out in the most populated part of the country. There's a relatively low density of correctional colonies, and most of the correctional colonies are, you know, begin here in the peripheries of the most settled part, most densely populated part of Russia, and goes up into Siberia. So you have a pattern of donor and recipient regions in Russia. So, you know, Moscow exports its prisoners sometimes 1,000 miles up into the Arctic Circle, for example, in particularly in the case of political prisoners. And there's just been a really interesting Amnesty International report. I said it's interesting, I was involved in it as well. So, yeah, it's a good report on the pains of the prison transportation. Okay. So, in order to try to sort of square the circle of, you know, the prisons, the correctional colonies being a long, long way away, and the requirement under the sort of Council of Europe and European prison rules, requirement to support socially useful contacts, support family life, the Russian Prison Service has sort of tried to upgrade its visiting conditions for visits, and although they still are incredibly ungenerous compared with other jurisdictions. So you can go for a short visit, but you're only for standard regime prisoners allowed 6 of those a year, but you're allowed in addition 4 what are known as long visits or residential visits, where you can stay for 3 nights with your prisoner in a special dormitory, along with where you have a single room, as you can see here, and where you're confined to that room for the 3 days, together with your prisoner, but a whole lot of other prisoners' families as well in this block with the prisoners. And in many respects, you know, the Russian Federation is very progressive, but it's a progressiveness that is in allowing these residential visits, but it's a progressiveness that has been forced upon them by the geography of the prison estate. They also have colony open days to try to encourage people to bring children along. I'm not going to talk about them, they're extraordinary things. But there are lots of, and there are other sort of ways that they've tried to improve contacts with prisoners' families. They now have, you can do internet ordering of food for your prisoner rather than having to go with all the bags to the colony. They have Skype for the most distant prisons, but the prisoners tend to get married at their, by just having illegal phones and iPads and so on, which circulate very widely in the prison service. Okay, so I've not got very much time left. What I've got is a series just of quotations from some of our interviews about the various stages of going on a visit. So one of the things about the journey is that they can be incredibly long. So this is Saima, one of the people we interviewed, who had first a 27-hour train journey to the Arctic Circle. And then what she says here is what happened, what she had to do after she'd arrived in the Arctic Circle. You know, you have to be pretty fit, and you also need a lot of money if you're going to be able to make these journeys. This is another one, but I'll skip over that. When they arrive at the colonies, the women are subjected to the usual sort of degradation rituals. They're subjected to body searches if it's thought that they might be sort of concealing drugs or whatever. One of the things is that on the journey, there are various markers that mark them out that show that they are prisoners' relatives. And it's always the large bags, it's having to sleep at railway stations when they get in these big prison regions, because you tend to have sort of these great carceral collections, you know, where there are 40 or so correctional colonies quite close to one another. And then what happens is the taxi drivers put up the fares, and or people refuse to pick them up and so on. So by the time they arrive and they're waiting at the prison gate, it's pretty clear that they are a prisoner's relative. So here, I shall do it in 1 minute, is a quotation from Olya visiting, Olya and Gulia, and it just shows that the sort of treatments they're subjected to when they arrive at the colony, where they're forced to stand out on the street, wait several hours before they can get in to see their loved one. So this is an example of, this is Luba, who is a Zalchnitsa, this is a social media wife, who was visiting her husband and it shows that she was subjected also to an internal search to make sure she wasn't bringing in any illicit items. So when they arrive, they go into the, if they're going to go for an extended visit, for a three-night visit, they spend 3 days with their loved one in the stormatory. And there are lots of really, really interesting behaviours that that one can observe, or that they when they're narrating their experiences, that you can identify, that actually are very similar to the sort of things that Megan Comfort has described for US jails, but with some Russian peculiarities. So what you find is somebody like Valia, who had a very abusive relationship with her husband, in that the concept of the prison, which is for her, of course, a very safe environment, and for him, it's an escape for 3 days from the hyper-macho environment of the correctional colony. They can reenact and re-perform their courtship rituals, which you can see that she says here. So it's not just unbridled, unadorned sex. He's behaving in precisely the way that women, or we're led to understand, women want their men to behave, which, you know, interestingly takes place within this confined penal space. They can also have fantasy play, and Megan Comfort's talked about this. Now, this is a description of the first meeting of Lumba with her future husband, Danielle, whom they decided to marry on her second meeting of him. So this was, and this is her first meeting, and you can say it's a very romanticized view of their meeting. So it was love at first sight, you want to see. We just sat for 10 minutes in silence and looked each other straight in the eye, etc., etc. And you know, he kept saying he loved her, and she was resisting this. I've never met you before. This is the first time I've seen you. But then by the end, she wasn't able. She couldn't hold back. In the end, Daniel, I love you. And they got married and had a colony wedding. And we finished on. The point I wanted to make about this is then when you talk to the women about, well, look, how did you feel? What was it like going home? And so on. They start explaining how stressful this was, how empty they were left. And one of the points I'd make is that if you're only doing this once a year, which is, you know, what often happens, you might be entitled to 4, but very few people can afford to go for 4 extended visits. If it's once a year, it becomes such an exaggerated set of expectations about it. And even though in their narratives they're saying, oh, it was wonderful, it was so romantic, in fact, quite a high proportion of certainly the people we interviewed, as a result of these journeys to the colonies, were taking the decision never to go again. And that was on both parties. So in fact, what appears to be this very progressive entitlement that there is in the Russian prison system to have these long visits for all prisoners, apart from certain ones, but for most prisoners, in fact, it turns out to be counterproductive because it's happening so infrequently because of the geography of the prison estate. So I think the point I would make then is that it is Valia talking about how she felt afterwards, is that the Russian prison service is doing everything but the obvious thing to solve this problem, to square this circle. One is to send fewer people to prison, and the other thing is to restructure the prison estate and bring it much closer to the populated parts of the country and the metropolitan centres. I'm just going to finish with a quotation from one of the original Dickovisky, Princess Maria Balkonskaya, 1826-27, when she was told by people how exceptional she'd been to go all the way to Siberia in her troika and dedicate her life to her husband. She said, "What's so surprising about it? 5,000 women do the same every year. Unfortunately, in the Russian Federation at the present day, it's much more than 5,000 women who have relatives in jail." Sorry.